Welcome to Bombshell. I'm Erin Simpson.
I'm Lauren DeYoung Shulman.
And I'm Radha Iyengar.
And we have a pretty full plate. Thanks for indulging us for kind of a midwinter break 2 weeks ago. Radha was in a very sunny and warm place, also known as the greatest place on earth, in Hawaii. So welcome back, Radha.
Thank you, mostly. Sadness a little.
Yeah, you made the mistake we've all made, which is coming back.
That's right.
It's not really the way it's done. Lauren and I are back to normal selves, and I will, I think, have the distinct joy of flying out of our local airport after most of our recordings for the next few weeks. So this is always a welcome respite from my day job. But we have a lot to talk about this week, and we're going to, I think, go ahead and dive right in with our guest.
So we are joined this week by Sarah Charles, a former colleague of Radha and I at the National Security Council, where she was the Director of Strategic Planning and also Director of Humanitarian Affairs. She previously worked at USAID, and we brought her on today because she was involved heavily in the Ebola response in, I guess this was in 2014, 2015, in the Obama administration, and we wanted to chat with her about how lessons from that experience as applied right now to coronavirus and other hot and less hot takes of the pandemic disease topics today. But first, of course, we need to start with our bombshell question. So welcome, Sarah.
Thank you. Long-time listener, first-time caller.
Fabulous.
I think you get to inaugurate our questions, right? Like we did.
That's what we were trying to remember if anyone else had answered them besides us at this point. And we'll pretend that you are the very first. Okay, so Erin, do you want to kick him off?
Sure. Okay, Sarah. What skill or talent do you wish you had?
So I do not have a pithy answer here. I earnestly really would like to be better at languages, and I am ready to turn over all of my data to Google to implant something in my brain that makes me fluent in a number of languages.
Well, that also suggests your answer to our household robot question, but we'll wait for a few minutes to get to that one.
No, I have bigger ambitions for the household robot.
What book do you wish you could live in forever?
I have a hard time coming up with one that I want to live in forever, but the one that I am currently living in is Mohsen Hamid's Exit West.
Oh, I've heard about that one. I have not read it, though.
It's excellent. I highly recommend it. It is, even though I would imagine it was written sometime in kind of 2015, 2016, it feels very urgent, given what's going on in Idlib and on the shores of Greece right now. But I do feel like generally kind of the migration, the refugee genre can be a bit maudlin or a bit saccharine. And this one is so good in just how human and specific and funny and sexy it is. So highly, highly recommend.
What place do you wish that you could visit before climate change destroys it? Which we were told this is like our most depressing question we've ever done, but we'll try to bring some uplift to it.
I know this one doesn't feel very, very fun. I guess to stay on topic, I would say Venice. Mm-hmm. And there's probably some joke in there about cheap airfare, but in all seriousness, hopefully when Northern Italy recovers from COVID, we can all send some tourist dollars their way.
Yeah,
Italy. I did see a tweet about how, you know, all the boomers are canceling their cruises and all the millennials have bought, you know, tickets on Spirit Air to 5 different islands. So don't do that. I don't recommend that course of action, but
it is impressive how Italy has somehow managed to actually codify its separatist movement of the Liga Nord so that like nobody can go in, nobody can go out now. And people are like, oh, is this actually what we wanted? I'm not sure it is what we wanted. I guess we'll find out.
Lots of second and third order effect.
Yeah,
we'll get to that. We'll get to that. More importantly, Sarah, if you could have a household robot, what would it do?
You know, I want sort of, an Alice from the Jetsons that super, super smart. I really wish we could direct some of this AI learning towards the logistics and scheduling of summer camp. I feel like
yes.
I think we're all going to wish for robot childcare here in the next month, if not sooner.
That's also true. But if one could just take off of my plate kind of three different children for 10 weeks with some combination of friends and interest and affordability and logistics, I feel like once the robots figure that out, they are ready for world domination.
Yeah, I have a follow-up request for them, which is preschool applications.
Okay, well, with that bit of levity behind us, we now have to move into our current horseman of the apocalypse. So there's a lot going on here.
It's raining frogs. I feel like we're just going to skip the actual substance and drink the whole episode. That's it.
Oh, yeah. We did not note what we are drinking, I think largely because it's morning and we're not drinking anything especially interesting. I do have some delicious coffee cake that my brother made me. So get you a brother who makes you amazing coffee cake.
I'm only drinking my fourth cup of coffee right now because I went out for Mongolian hot pot last night and consumed it with a pitcher of very cheap beer, which apparently I am not well equipped to have anymore. So but it was great.
Yeah, this podcast has moved from like amazing scotch and like great beer that people have sent us to Sunday morning hangover remedies, which is probably consistent with both our lot in life.
I was like, I feel like that follows the arc of the last few years.
Yes, exactly. Okay, so Radha, do you want to maybe bring us up to speed a little bit? We talked about Corona in some degrees in our last episode, but that would have been literally a month ago at this point. So there's a lot of new data that we have, but there's still a lot that's unresolved. And we're not going to, I think, dive into great detail on exact mortality rates or some of those questions, but bring us up to speed, Radha.
Yeah. So I think at a high level, almost everyone who's listening and probably most people everywhere know we have sort of pandemic on our hands related to coronavirus COVID-19, which is basically a very infectious flu-like disease that has potentially higher fatality rates, especially among the elderly. The initial outbreak, I think, was largely targeted at in China, in Wuhan, but since over the last month, it's spread globally with major outbreaks in I think, every continent except Antarctica, and most states in the United States now are having confirmed cases. And I think where we are here and maybe just sort of pivoting to some of the discussion with Sarah is trying to think about what has the government response been? What should it be? What should we be looking for? And kind of what are the risks or things we should worry about when the government response differs from where we want it to be? And I think given the experience with Ebola, maybe, Sarah, you could just kind of kick us off. And what is the government's actual role? Like, what can it be doing right now? And what is that? What should we be looking for?
Fundamentally, when we think about, both domestically and internationally, we think about kind of who's in the supporting and who's in the supported role, which is probably language that's familiar to some of your audience. And the reality is that in the United States, our public health response is primarily done by local and state authorities. And that's the case with almost all disaster response. But we are, fundamentally a federal system, which is not to say that the federal government doesn't have a huge role to play, particularly when you're dealing with a novel crisis like the COVID-19 crisis is. And so, there are a couple of things we look to the federal government for. One is, first and foremost, kind of information, trusted, correct, clear, transparent information sharing, both about the state of what we know about the disease, but also how local and state authorities should be responding and facilitating that kind of information sharing as well, both with authorities and with the public. The other things we look for is the federal government has a lot of tools to direct resources towards state and local authorities. So both identifying and coordinating how those resources are distributed and how to get resources quickly into who needs them the most. The other thing we look for them to do is what we're seeing out of NIAID and NIH, which is to spur development of therapeutics and vaccines. And then what is most critical, I'd say, in kind of a novel crisis, and what the White House's role in particular is in every crisis, there are going to be bottlenecks. We're dealing with a lot of overlapping authorities and a lot of different actors. So they're going to be bottlenecks and they're going to be screw ups. And one thing we really look to the White House in particular and to leadership for is quickly identifying and addressing those bottlenecks, anticipating screw ups, and having a plan B and C for when those screw ups inevitably happen.
Digging in a little there, I think you have a particularly unique perspective here, having sort of done some of the process work on the during the Ebola crisis. Based on sort of the processes there, what is your kind of one? What did we learn from that? Are there things we should be lifting from that experience here? And in particular, are there things that you see that are going really well or not based on your experience from that crisis?
I think we learned a few things from that crisis. One is that infectious disease is inherently a global challenge. And one thing that we realized pretty early on in the Ebola response, and you know, Radha, you were involved in some of the early days of this, is the way we were organized was to think about the domestic dimension and the global dimension, but not the intersection of the global and the domestic dimension. So how decisions about domestic preparedness, whether it be about kind of stockpiles or supply trains or travel bans, would impact the ability to mount a global response. And that, frankly, you know, we weren't organized at the White House to have kind of a whole of government, global, integrated global and domestic response to the crisis. We also identified a lot of gaps in, frankly, domestic preparedness. That there were a lot of times where I think those of us that were on the Ebola task force, you know, might have going into the crisis assumed that there were capabilities that existed in state and local governments and in the federal government that frankly just did not exist, you know, both in terms of isolation and quarantine capacities. Waste management was something that we spent months thinking and dealing with, triage capabilities, standard operating procedures, how we use and think about deploying Department of Defense assets during a domestic public health emergency. So there were a lot of kind of problems that we didn't have ready off-the-shelf solutions to. And so we needed to quickly develop processes for identifying those problems, addressing those problems, putting in place both immediate and longer term solutions to those problems. And that's where you really had one of the lessons learned coming out of the Ebola response, was that you needed a focal point on the National Security Council, on the White House, that was specifically focused on global health and bio threats. And that could be when we weren't in the midst of an emergency, could be identifying these challenges, exercising these capabilities, working with the agencies to identify what resources were needed, working with the Hill to put in place longer term resources to respond to these challenges. And then most critically, in the event of an emergency, having kind of a single point in the White House for identifying early that we had a crisis on our hands and setting up the structures, you know, whether they be a task force or regular deputies meetings, to, again, quickly identify the capabilities that would be needed, the bottlenecks and appropriate responses. And also, frankly, to do that kind of plan B, plan C, plan D work that that frankly we're not seeing a lot of right now.
And is that because that role was eliminated?
I think it's a combination of things. And I do think it's a real failure that that role was eliminated. It was put there for a reason. And, you know, I try not to pay too close attention to what the president is saying on a daily basis about COVID. But when he gave a press conference on Friday at the CDC and talked about kind of this is a new thing that no one could have anticipated, the fact of the matter is, there were a lot of people that did, in fact, anticipate that we would have a novel infectious disease challenge, likely during this administration. And that's why we put in place those structures. And it's also, frankly, why the Presidential Transition Act mandates that you exercise and, you know, an infectious disease crisis was one of the things that we exercised with the incoming team because we felt like it was such a likely possibility and also something that the new team coming in might not have top of mind in the way that they would have, you know, the challenge from North Korea or a CT challenge, the types of things that kind of the national security infrastructure is more used to talking and thinking about.
That was like six national security advisors and two secretaries of defense ago. Really was. So we've had a little turnover. I'm actually thrilled to hear that was part of the transition, that there was an effort to draw attention to it.
It was. And I actually, and you know, kind of this morning I had a moment of just Googling the readout from that because I was having a hard time remembering, you know, who was around the table. And when you do look at the readout, who was there from the, on the Trump side of the transition, you know, there's no one from the Trump national security staff team that's still there. And there are only a handful of cabinet members that are cabinet officials that are still there and just a handful of White House officials that were in the room for that. So the turnover in the administration has consequences, not just at the kind of civil service level, but also even at the senior political level.
Sarah, one of the things I wanted to ask about, which you talked about, was that domestic and international integration that is often lacking in many of our foreign policy issues, but is particularly acute in this one of a global pandemic. I've been curious to understand if the United States, as it appears to be, goes down the path of having a real pandemic health crisis domestically. How much is that going to limit our ability to provide assistance, enabling capabilities, and other kind of support to other countries who may be going through the same? I mean, obviously, the United States played a really vital role in Ebola in West Africa several years ago and has in other public health crises worldwide as well. But if our resources are drawn to it on a domestic front, is that going to put a real limitation on our ability to support? And are there other countries that are able to kind of help meet that gap?
It's a good question. I think there are a couple of different ways that the U.S. plays a real leadership role in responding globally, some of which will be more affected than others. One way is resources. And in some ways, a domestic threat, a dirty little secret, a domestic threat can be helpful in mobilizing the resources for a global response as well. So it wasn't until we had cases in the United States that we got an Ebola supplemental out of Congress that obviously had a large domestic preparedness component, but also, you know, had significant resources for the response in West Africa and critically significant resources to fund the global health security agenda in a robust way, which was really, you know, kind of an Obama era initiative to support national health authorities to identify and respond to infectious disease threats, and that we're seeing, you know, the positive impact of this investment just starting to emerge now. Similarly, you know, this administration put out a budget request for the COVID response that didn't include any resources for a global response. But I think because there had been so much education on the Hill about the domestic global nexus that you had the appropriators on their own initiative put in a couple of billion resources for the overseas dimension, both in terms of immediate humanitarian response, a little bit of money for the longer term global health security agenda response, and critically, some not sufficient but important resources for economic support funds. The other piece of it, though, is we have in the past played a really important diplomatic role in overseas pandemic response. It's not a role we seem to be playing now, but also we're used to playing a much more robust role diplomatically in terms of mobilizing resources for the global response. And our funding of WHO has been pretty modest, but the global funding of WHO has been really pretty anemic considering what we anticipate the effects of this virus to be globally. And we played, you know, almost no role in marshaling resources for WHO's response.
Sarah, can I ask you to maybe flip that question around, which is, you know, given there's global impact of this right now, and there's certainly some countries that are in different phases of monitoring and treating their local disease outbreaks. It seems like there's maybe some success stories. And so I'm kind of wondering, what could we be learning from a place like South Korea, which has done very aggressive testing, Singapore, which has done very extensive surveillance, and Hong Kong, which it seems actually had such successful social distancing that their seasonal flu numbers are quite a bit down. Now, obviously, Hong Kong has a unique history with SARS and a very different set of kind of cultural norms and population density practices. But I'm wondering, if there are some good lessons, that we can learn there, and that we might be able to integrate into that domestic response we were discussing.
Yeah, no, I mean, I would say because of SARS, because of H1N1, places like Singapore, South Korea, Japan, and Hong Kong are, I think, particularly well exercised in how to deal with a novel respiratory illness like this. The U.S. has some unique strengths and unique challenges in dealing with an infectious disease threat. We have a highly decentralized health system, which, there are some pros to that, but cons in terms of our ability to kind of mount the type of surveillance operation that Singapore in particular has mounted. So, I think that the lesson learned, unfortunately, it may be a little late to learn one of the lessons, which is early identification of cases, significant testing and contact tracing. I mean, I fear we're probably past the, again, I'm not a medical doctor, not an infectious disease specialist, but I fear we're probably past the point of contact tracing being being an important part of the response here in the U.S. But certainly the social distancing, the behavior change practices, again, it really helps when you have public health authorities that are front and center, that are giving clear guidance and that are trusted by the population.
I did notice that this week Anthony Fauci was out on the Sunday shows instead of Vice President Pence, and I think that's a good shift. And he had some very clear, guidance, especially for the elderly. Although I love that, his note for the elderly is like 60 and over, so we're not just talking about like 90-year-olds, right? So like all of the, boomers with cruises need to not go on cruises, right?
It's true. And I do feel like that has been one of the lessons learned. And it was something that, again, I think as soon as Ebola became a domestic threat, there was kind of widespread consensus within the White House. Like, let's put Tony Fauci out as much as possible because there are fewer voices in the United States that are as trusted on these issues as Tony Fauci. And I think he's shown, even in the last month or so, his willingness to risk running a little bit afoul of the president in order to maintain his credibility and to give accurate and reasonable information.
I agree. I think in some senses, to my mind, the biggest concern and gap that's been coming up is the question on sort of credibility of sources and credibility of data, credibility of measurement and some of the testing. I think as we sort of wrap up here and think about going forward, do you have sort of any thoughts on effective processes or practices other than just single voices that might be helpful in providing clear guidance and sort of building trust in what's happening on the government response, again, based on, I think, in some senses, the Ebola response, at least my sort of view of the arc of it was in the beginning, it felt like there was a lot of confusion about what was going on. And in the end, there was a lot of clarity as to what the risks are, how they could be contained, what the government's response is. So based on that arc, kind of, were there any things that you feel like really, if they hammered that home in this crisis, we could be in a better place, a couple months from now?
I think there are a couple of things that I would flag. One is at every level, incident management and command and control, clarity around kind of incident management structures and command and control are important. So at the local level, at the state level, and at the level of the White House, having absolute clarity about who are the decision makers, what's the pace of meeting and decision making, what are the escalation pathways for when there are problems, and how how are those decisions communicated out? And that has to happen, again, at every level, at the local, at the state, and at the federal level. And we still have a lot of confusion about roles and responsibilities at the federal level, who's in charge, and how those escalation pathways are working. The other, you know, the other lesson learned is pandemics and epidemics are ultimately stopped by people, and in particular by behavior change. And so again, real clarity from the, you know, the Tony Faucis and others about what you as individuals can do at different stages of the threat, and what you want people to do during a kind of containment stage is different than what you want people to do during a mitigation stage. In a containment stage, you do want to encourage a lot of people to seek testing. At a mitigation stage, you want to prioritize those who are most vulnerable, as well as protect, you know, again, protect the healthcare facilities from being overwhelmed, not least of which because we get as worried about second order effects.
Thanks so much for joining us, Sarah. It's really helpful to think through policy responses and coordination. And I know Radha and I are eager to dig into some of the data questions, which I'm sure we'll have ample opportunity to do over the next few weeks. So thanks for joining us. Good luck as you engage on this, you know, more broadly, and we'll all keep our eyes open for it.
Thank you.
All right, shifting gears to the other horsemen of the apocalypse, we'll do a little keeping up foreign relations. And this first one, I guess, arguably could be White House mayhem or the other, but let's spend a little bit of time on the Afghanistan peace deal. Again, we're a few weeks after this had kind of first broke a couple weeks ago. I still had all of my tabs open from researching it.
I feel like it needs to be air quotes peace, air quotes deal.
Yes, these are all things that we could debate around. So there was an agreement signed on February 29th, which I sort of laughed when I noted down that date because it meant that there would not have to be very many like anniversary celebrations, right? Because
that's a great point. We don't have to remember it happening.
But that agreement was signed in Doha by representatives from the United States and the Taliban. And I think, you know, we've talked about this several times as we've both discussed peace negotiations that were happening last summer and then ultimately fell apart. But fundamentally, the Taliban has not negotiated at all with the Afghan government because they still don't recognize the legitimacy of the Afghan government. There was a lot of speculation on kind of what was going to be in this deal, what exactly was going to be agreed to. And I think one of the things that's interesting is that there's still speculation because a lot of the details are in these two secret annexes. Members of Congress had access to those this week. Tom Alinowski in particular was quite incensed that these were being kept from the American public. He thought there was no reason to continue doing so. But of course, then things have leaked about what is in the annexes and what is or is not agreed to.
And just one other note, there was also a release of a U.S.-Afghan, with the government we recognize, joint declaration on the same day on the 29th with some aligned but not fully aligned commitments from both sides in how they might approach this deal. So that was like the closest we've come to having them involved in this.
Right. I mean, I guess, you know, a couple of things that one thing I would note and then two things that I'm watching. One thing I would note is that there's often a lot of vague language in agreements like this because that's how you get people to agree to it. And you're basically including a number of confidence building measures that try to get people to continue talking. And so it's actually a part where the State Department norms of the point of the meeting is to have the meeting are very much in tension with kind of DOD norms, where like the point of the meeting is to make a decision or to set up for future action. The point of these is just to continue having these, you know, discussions and negotiations. There's some speculation when we get to this next concern that was deliberate. It's hard to say one way or the other, but these kinds of agreements are often somewhat vague in order to let people read into them what they need to read into them at the time. So two things that I'm watching. One is this discussion around prisoner swap. And so essentially the Taliban were told to expect a substantial prisoner release at the time of signing. The Americans said that they would work with the Afghan government to do so. The Afghan government, Ashraf Ghani in particular, was like, oh, hell no. So this was a pretty big stumbling block right out the gates. Both suggest that the Afghan government is sort of out of step. Also suggests the United States may not be able to get its, you know, partner on the Afghan side to follow up with what we've signed up to. So that's sort of concerning. The second piece that I'm watching is very much, there's a lot of discussion about intra-Afghan negotiations. I'm actually interested in the intra-Afghan government discussions. Both Ashraf Ghani and Abdullah sent each other invitations to their own inauguration parties this weekend as they were both trying to get themselves inaugurated as president of Afghanistan. So there's a really significant rift.
That's helpful.
Yeah, amongst the Afghan civilian leaders. And, you know, interesting things like General Dostum is actually a part of Abdullah's party and part of his coalition. If things start to get real sporty, it's going to matter, you know, who is able to mobilize or command useful military forces. And, you know, the Afghan National Army and Afghan National Security Forces are but one set of armed groups in the country. And so watching both the, you know, government versus Taliban signaling, but also very much the internecine Afghan politics, which are kind of fractured at a very unhelpful point.
And I have one sort of additional thing I'm watching, which is, so nested in the agreement was also this statement on what the relationship between the Taliban and Al-Qaeda, but also other sort of armed groups could or should be. And it's a little messy. And actually, there's an excellent Lawfare piece on this that I'll link in our show notes. But essentially, the agreement between the U.S. and the Taliban specifies not allowing these armed groups to amass and form a threat to the United States or its allies. The declaration between the United States and the Afghan government has much stronger language, and in particular, not allowing any sort of engagement or involvement by the government with these armed actor groups, which are two actually pretty different things. And the last piece is, absent knowing what's in the secret annexes, it's very difficult to understand what the United States agreed sort of intel posture will be, both in terms of determining compliance, but also in terms of actually assessing what is happening with groups on the ground. And when you couple that with the sort of troop drawdown, you know, I think we learned in the Iraq and then later Syria cases that understanding on the ground conditions with these armed actors is very difficult, especially without forces and elements on the ground. And so there's a really big open question about both compliance, but also the substantive like threat vectors that sort of formed the basis of this conflict many moons ago.
Yeah, I mean, I guess we should say that the, you know, bottom line piece of this is that this is an agreement that sets the terms for American withdrawal within 14 months. And a reduction of U.S. troops down to sort of the 8,000 level that it was at the beginning of Trump's term in relatively short order. So that's kind of the backstop. The other piece, and this is, you know, I'm relatively in favor of significant reductions of our force posture in Afghanistan. It's not clear that we got a lot for this deal, right? Kathy Gilsonen has a good piece in the Atlantic kind of noting the dialing down of expectations over time. And it's hard to say. I mean, we did not get great language, Radha, as you note, on Al-Qaeda presence. We did not get great language on recognition of minority rights or women's rights, by which I mean none. So, you know, there's the Taliban did not sign up to a lot in order to get this initial, you know, reduction in violence and then a commitment of U.S. troops to withdraw in 14 months. So a lot of interesting things to explore here, and hopefully we'll get it in, you know, deeper. I'm very interested in whether there'll be some sort of DDR, disarmament, demobilization, reintegration process. I'm very interested to see, you know, if there's some other process by which, like, the Afghan government can adopt the Taliban taxation structure, because they're the only people in Afghanistan apparently who can collect any taxes. But we're a long way from there right now, and we're definitely stumbling a bit out of the gates. So
I just had one final comment, sort of a meta comment on the Trump administration here, in that it has been typical in other foreign policy issues that President Trump has wanted to himself very personally play a deal-making, deal-closing role, whether it be to some degree he tried to instigate this with Iran, did not work out, North Korea, and other topics. He was not allowed to for the Taliban, or I guess he followed the advice of others to say that we, the United States, should not be putting the president in the place of personally negotiating with the political lead of the Taliban, and had to defer a lot of this. Well, no, I'll note the phone call. Don't worry. I see the face you're making, Aaron. But had to defer of this a lot to his special envoy, Zal Khalilzad. And as a result, I think it's an interesting model to follow in other issues. Is there anything else that, frankly, that we can make sure that Trump does not mess up for us so that it can actually be come to closure in some way. Probably not a lot of topics, but like the negotiation with the Taliban was an interesting example. He did, however, have a phone call with the political leader of the Taliban,
Mullah Berader.
He's on the
phone with Mullah Berader.
As a, like, once the deal was done, sort of like, I don't know, thank you. But I'm just sort of imagining the dynamic in the Situation Room to call up to the Oval to say, please hold for political leader of the Taliban, Mullah Berader. And just like, what would that feel like as the Situation Room lead in that case to be able to say those words? And oh, God, it's just fascinating to think about.
All right, we'll have lots more on that. Let's move on to our next interesting spot. There were elections again in Israel?
Third set of elections. And actually, so I was reading a piece this morning. I won't say the news outlet, but I'm not entirely... I'm pretty certain that they copied and pasted a lot of the analysis from the prior election going in, which would, to be fair, it's totally legitimate because there's a lot of dynamics that are the same where Benjamin Netanyahu's coalition came out with a slight lead, but not enough to form their own governing coalition. The Blue and White Party was slightly below them. Avigdor Lieberman has a block of like 9 seats or so in the Knesset that could basically makes him kingmaker. However, this is Sunday, so things could change. It appears that even though Netanyahu was kind of celebrating this on the day of the election on Monday, Tuesday, by the end of last week, it seemed as though Lieberman was once again kind of leaning more towards Benny Gantz, the Blue and White Party, by making a series of commitments or a series of agreements that seemed as though he was not going to go with Netanyahu this time. But we've seen this movie before. What is different about this election versus a prior one is that Netanyahu has actually been indicted. Lieberman has committed to support a piece of legislation that would prevent any office holder who has been indicted from holding office or becoming prime minister. He has...
That's not subtle,
you know,
right?
I mean. It's not subtle, but he's made a commitment like this before. It looks like Gantz has said that, like, I totally will agree to all of Lieberman's requirements to form some kind of governing coalition. They have not, like, come out and said, and we have formed it. But my favorite moment in all of this was when Netanyahu apparently is trying to, like, stir up some corruption or election mischief allegation against Lieberman. And Lieberman's official press release was just a series of laughing, crying emojis. And that's it.
2020, ladies and gentlemen.
Exactly.
All right. I don't think we have much else to say on that. And we're running just short of time. Can we switch gears to one of Israel's neighbors and discuss what on earth is going on in Syria?
Indeed.
Yeah. And this,
please enlighten me, because I definitely totally missed this plot line last week. And this is one of those ones that, like, I don't know when I would ever catch back up.
And in fairness, it's like kind of second verse, same as the first. Yeah. So here, where we are is there's a brokered ceasefire between Turkey and Syria, brokered by the Russians. So really,
I'm sorry,
when
what
I say
now?
Syria, I mean Assad. So basically, there's been this fighting in the northern part of Syria, Idlib being the most notable part. Assad forces, it's been a Assad opposition stronghold, and Assad forces have sort of engaged in a pretty aggressive push into the region to take it back. Turkey had been fighting up there for a number of reasons, but largely bolstering the rebels. And this more or less pulls Turkey back from supporting Idlib, more or less cedes that territory to Assad. So that's probably not going to be great for humanitarian issues. The ceasefire seems to be holding. I feel like we're like on day 2, maybe day 3. And I think this is a pretty big win for Assad and pretty well establishes the Russians as the sort of power that is the external power that's helping mediate and manage this process, which may or may not be good for U.S. interests, depending on what you think U.S. interests in Syria are. But there's also a truly tremendous humanitarian crisis that was already coming from Idlib and is likely to increase in days that has spilled over. So I think it's about 4 million refugees. And Turkey is just basically full up on refugees, and so has declared that refugees are allowed to go wherever they want. Turkey is no longer containing them. And there are a bunch of refugees now literally banging on the gates to enter Europe via Greece. Greece has closed its borders. The EU is maintaining those closed borders. It is resulting in water cannons and rocks being thrown by Greece Border Patrol, allegations of tear gas being used by Turkish forces. So the Greek-Turkish border is also not great. Not great, guys. There should be a meeting this week with Turkey and EU leaders. Turkey says the EU hasn't lived up to its commitments to help Turkey deal with the inflow of refugees, which is probably true. The EU says they're not going to take in refugees because they're not vetted, and there could be militants coming through as well, which is also probably true.
Turkey's history on that is not great. Yeah.
Yeah. Europe's history is not great on this either.
Also true. This sounds like a mess.
Yeah, it's kind of a mess. It's kind of also, but like the mess we've been living that is the Syria crisis for some time, right?
So
this is a little amped up for the next few days. And I think the Greece border is particularly like sort of troublesome. But I'm not sure there's like a ton of deeply new developments here other than really establishing Russia as being the external power that's in the lead here.
I love great power competition in the morning. It's fantastic.
You know what's a really great idea in the middle of all of these crises? The White House has pursued the best possible approach. Let's get rid of the chief of staff and put in a new one.
And send him to Northern Ireland.
And send him to Northern Ireland, which, by the way, does not have a real crisis going on. And put in a new one who is the head of the Freedom Caucus. So, you know.
Nothing could go wrong.
No wrong. So Mick Mulvaney, who has never...
So have we moved on to White House mayhem, is what you're telling me?
We have.
So, did we ever really leave it?
We didn't.
Mick Mulvaney, who has been acting White House Chief of Staff for 14 months, which I feel like that's when you've been dating your boyfriend for a really long time and he still introduces you to his parents as his close friend. He has...
Does he go back to OMB now?
No.
No, he's going to Northern Ireland.
No, he's going to Northern Ireland. So we are not only losing...
But is he still going to be head of OMB?
No.
From Northern Ireland?
Well, you know what? Actually, this is...
Just checking.
You're asking a question that I'm saying no to automatically, but... However, the head of ODNI is still the ambassador to Germany. So who knows? I don't know. Maybe you can do all these jobs at once. Mulvaney is out. Mark Meadows of birther conspiracy fame is in the middle of all of this. The assumption was that at the end of the impeachment crisis, Trump would probably get rid of Mulvaney. He's wanted to for a long time, but was persuaded that would be sending the wrong message. I don't know what message this sends now to put Mark Meadows in. But he's in,
I mean,
all the family.
So at one level, I mean, this is extremely nihilistic, but this is clearly where we are. Does it matter? It's not like there's a process that's being run anyway.
But I think the only way it matters is that Trump is increasing the loyalty of the circle of loyalists around him. Like, he was already in a place of, like, if you work for Trump, you are 100% in this game. And Mulvaney apparently has, you know, I guess he coughed in a press conference one time, and therefore he's dead to Trump at that point. Meadows has always been very much on the Trump bandwagon since the very beginning. And this actually kind of leads a bit into the challenge that we're seeing at OSD and Department of Defense, where we have, like, I think the highest number of vacancies that you've seen in this administration, except during the changeover in administrations where you had no civilian appointees coming in. Apparently, what is going on is that Mark Esper actually is trying to put in place a number of folks to head up OSD policy, which has... Only 2 out of 7 Senate-confirmed personnel are actually in place, and one of them is fulfilling an acting role. There's a lot of other gaps across the services and across OSD. He has possible nominees for this, but the White House has basically said, we want our people, and if you've ever said anything negative about Trump, then you're not in. It would be difficult to find a human being on Earth who has not said something negative about Trump, so I wish them the best of luck in pursuing that objective, but that's where we are with... Very little civilian oversight of the Department of Defense right now. And there's nothing going on in the world. I'm sure that everything's going fine with that.
Yeah, there's some, I think Alice Hunt had a really great set of comments around why civilian oversight requires civilian professionals. And you can't just have folks in acting capacities or on loan from other agencies or people in uniform fulfilling those duties.
Indeed.
So that's definitely a challenge. Although... I'm sure that the joint staff will be happy to step into the breach and just manage their way through all of those challenges. Can we talk about pop culture?
Let's do it.
I have one thing related to our conversation earlier as we were talking about Dr. Anthony Fauci. Lauren, what was the fun fact you discovered about him?
He's been in the same job since the 80s.
And the reason I knew that is because I read And the Band Played On, and then I watched the HBO movie based on that. And so if you want a fantastic trip into the Wayback Machine of an incredibly sad and tragic period, you can read And the Band Played On by Randy Schultz, which is about the initial outbreak of the AIDS epidemic and how mishandled the data was, how mishandled the responses were, and how kind of politicized public health response the kind of decade of the 1980s was for the infectious disease community and the gay community in the United States, among others. So very interesting portal into politicized outbreaks.
I was like, Aaron, I hope we have other pop culture because this is really not
my pop
culture. We do.
That's why I wanted
culture.
To start with that so that we can shift gears into two real shining lights. One extremely highbrow and one extremely not. Which should we start with?
Are you going to talk about Love is Blind?
Oh my God, Love is Blind.
So
this is the worst piece
it.
Of television.
I've never watched it, but watching people talk about it on Twitter is just an absolute treat.
Yeah. I mean, it's like I don't watch The Bachelor, like I don't watch Survivor, I don't watch any of these things. But basically, the premise is they take all of these reasonably conventionally attractive straight people, lock them up in a sort of, you know, apartment complex, have them talk to each other but not see each other, and then propose to each other. They're
sorry,
all like
proposed
vaguely
marriage?
Employed, minimally employed. Yes. And then the rest of the, you know, show is about their, like, you know, will they or will they not get married? And they send them to Mexico and they have to go home, meet parents. And it's also like, there's no commercials. So it's the most bingeable thing when we're all locked up and quarantined with coronavirus, people can binge watch Love is Blind.
Oh my God.
It's really something. It'll rot your brain a little, but like it's perfect to have on in the background while you're doing 16 other things because you don't have to pay attention that carefully.
Meanwhile,
something you do have to pay attention to extremely carefully.
Very carefully. Finally, at long last. We get to find out what happens to Thomas Cromwell because gosh, who knows?
Who knows?
The final alert. Book in the trilogy by Hilary Mantel, The Mirror and the Light, will be out on Tuesday.
Yay.
There's a strong possibility I'll be taking off work on Tuesday just to read it. We'll see. I'm also going to see Hilary Mantel on March 16th, and I'm so excited. But if you have not yet read this book, what are you doing? You've listened to Bombshell for years now, and we keep talking about it. It's time to pick up Wolf Hall, and then so you read it as fast as possible so you can finally read through those final installations.
Though sometimes when people haven't read like amazing books, I feel like a little jealous that they're going to get the experience
oh, absolutely.
Of first reading it, and you're like, oh, man.
Though if you're going to read it for the first time, I'm just going to warn you, the first few chapters are confusing. When they say he... They mean Thomas Cromwell. I'll just put
every
it
time.
Out there. Every single time.
It is. So I suggested, somebody was asking, Quinta was asking if she should reread Wolf Hall. And I said, well, you can always watch the PBS special, which is quite good. And it covers the first two books. And she says, I don't like it because Mark Rylance is too charming as
Cromwell.
As Cromwell.
Oh, interesting.
And,
oh.
And she she repeats the line back to me, you know, where he's surprised that he, you know, is that he's painted as a murderer.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't remember who it is that says back to him, didn't you know? Which is like such an amazing scene in the book. But I took her point. But if you would like, you know, if it's helpful to watch the PBS version and then read it, that does somehow clarify some of the plot points or whatnot. But it is fantastic. I look forward to reading the third book, and then I look forward to rereading all three of them forever and ever and ever.
Mm-hmm.
And with that,
on that very happy note, we will return our listeners to their apocalyptic lives.
And wash your hands.
See everybody in a couple weeks. Bye.